Log Talk Radio.
Friday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where you can call in and ask questions, tip us off for action in your area, or just fill us with on your mind. Let the authority smash begin.
Hello, wage slaves, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And tonight with your host, Mr. 1001 Nights, as well as various callers who will later ask questions and make comments about the events of the day. I want to remind you, you can check out our website, authoritysmashers.wordpress.com. That is authoritysmashers.wordpress.com. And I just burned my tongue with hot coffee. I'm like, can't talk. You can go to the website and check out our shows. They are stored there, our daily shows. You can email the administrator, myself, if you have any things you want to talk about, any questions. You can also follow us on iTunes, so just go to the website and follow the link to iTunes, and you can listen to us from your iPod, as well as you can donate if you want. As you know, our show keeps going, no matter what, but we do appreciate donations if you have a few dollars to spare. So anyway, we have a lot to talk about, and if you want to call in, let me remind you, the number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And Charnchi's informing me that I'm being cut in and out of the line, so if that keeps going, please let me know, Charnchi, and I'll have to play a clip while I solve the problem. So let me know how that is going. So I guess the first news item I'd like to talk about is the fact that there have been gigantic mid-Atlantic snowstorms, and scientists have actually said that they are consistent with global warming predictions. It says the extremely snowy and windy weather we've been experiencing in the Washington, D.C. area and the Mid-Atlantic region fits the pattern of global warming, say scientists. Quote, global warming theory predicts that global precipitation will increase and that heavy precipitation events will also increase, according to the 2007 UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. The explanation is that as the climate warms, evaporation of moisture from the ocean increases, which results in more water vapor in the air. And the extra moisture tends to produce heavier snowstorms, assuming it's cold enough to snow, that is. So the record-breaking blizzards are not evidence against human-caused global warming, as some non-scientist pundits and bloggers are gleefully promoting, but in fact they support the theory of human-caused global warming. And in fact, the huge snowstorms this winter in the Mid-Atlantic are a very rare event, we don't really see them very often. Apparently, every few hundred years, according to Dr. Jeff Masters, the director of meteorology for the Weather Underground. Not to be confused with the 1960s radical organization, Weather Underground. That is, absent dangerous global warming, says hotter air can hold more moisture, so when a storm gathers, it can unleash massive amounts of snow, says Masters. Says extreme violent weather is a visible sign of global warming that needs to be more widely recognized. In his 2004 book, Boiling Point, Ross Gelspan writes that journalists should use this phrase. Quote, the pattern is exactly what we expect from climate change, and we can expect more violent weather events in the future if emission trends are not reversed soon. So there you have it, folks. And at the same time, pretty sad but true, a climate scientist claimed to be losing the PR war. Says a Nobel Peace Prize winning Welsh physicist says climate change scientists are losing a PR war against skeptics with vested interests. Sir John Houghton said there were millions of internet references to a comment he never made, which appears to show him hyping up global warming. A poll for BBC News suggests the number of British people who are skeptical about climate change is rising. Sir John believes recent news stories may have contributed to skepticism. He told BBC Wales Dragon's Eye program, if you Google my name on the web and look for a quote, the quote you will find is one that goes like this. It says, unless we announce disasters, no one will listen. I've never said this. The origin of the quote, according to some of the people who write about it, comes from the first edition of my global warming book. But in any case, the fact that this boils down to so-called skeptics putting out propaganda, lying in order to discredit global warming theory, which has a ton of evidence backing it up, and for the interest of the corporate elite that basically runs the system. So, this is pretty sad, considering that in the end, it's going to harm even the corporate elite themselves, since their industries will be undermined by global warming. I guess on other news, on the labor front, to resist is to survive. Nearly 10 years after Argentina's economic collapse sparked a movement, worker-run cooperatives endure another crisis. Says, divisions within the movement, apathy from the government, and a lack of capital threaten the future of workers' factories. So, you know, that's a common theme. You know, the divisions within the movement have always been a problem because, you know, we're pretty independent-minded. We're also not used to working together. We haven't really had much experience as wage slaves of self-managing our own affairs, and therefore, that's a common problem at the beginning of any revolution, of any radical change, and you know, obviously, the lack of capital is one that we also face. I mean, how do you survive in a capitalist system, even as a cooperative, as a worker council, if you don't have the capital, you don't compete on the basis of the capitalist market system? So that's pretty obvious there. Anyway, we have a caller on the line, so let's see who this is. Hello.
Hey, what's going on?
Hi.
This is Brom. This is Brom Kiewicz. Who am I speaking with?
Oh, this is the host of the Authority Smashing Hour. Are you aware this is a show?
Sure. I got a message from Terry.
Well, we don't know anybody by
that
name.
What's the topic for this evening?
Well, we're talking about various issues, starting with labor news, global warming, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any comments you want to make?
No, I just called in.
Anyway, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, so we're gonna let him go. So, somebody called Juice Football says, "How do you take over the workplace?" I guess that's in the chat room. Well, the answer to that is that you can't just take over the workplace. Like as we speak, you can't just go tomorrow in the workplace and say, "I'm taking it over with the other workers," because you know, the fact is that the owner will call the police and they'll kick you out, right? Now, what you can do is in the short term, you can organize, you can ask for improvements, such as, you know, higher wages. You know, maybe you want to improve the safety of your workplace. Now, at some point, it comes a time where you start having more serious confrontations, and you know, you get sit-in strikes, you get other actions that more drastically confront the authority of the owner, and that's when you get closer to the to taking over the workplace or running it. But as of you know, if you start out from our current situation, it's going to be very tough because there's no base on which to implement such a drastic action. That is the very power of capitalism, the control over the workplace, over the means of production. So you can't just say, "Okay, I'm going to go tomorrow and take it over." It's a gradual process whereby you gain more say, you gain more influence, and then in the long term, you make inroads toward participatory control. So that's the answer. It's not easy, and I was recommending yesterday that people take a look at a book called Labor Notes, which talks about some of the tactics that workers have used to have more say at the workplace, to improve their conditions, and you know, even taking over the factories at some points and during the struggle, because that scares the hell out of the management and the owners of the factory, because that's one step away, just taking over the factory. So obviously there's other things that harm the cost of labor, and for example, unemployment. That is, you know, is one of the main purposes of that, is to lower the bargaining power of workers. So if you're easily replaceable, because there's a lot of people who are unemployed, then you're obviously going to have less bargaining power when it comes to raising your living standards, asking for more wages, et cetera, et cetera. So that's it. That's all I can say about that. Now, there's a new study that just came out showing that the lowest income Americans face a 30% unemployment rate. A new study says low income Americans are facing a higher unemployment rate today than at the height of the Depression. The Center for Labor Market Studies at Boston's Northeastern University divided U.S. households into 10 groups based on annual income. The lowest 10th, with an annual household income of $12,499 or less, had a fourth quarter unemployment rate last year of 30.8%. The next lowest income group had an unemployment rate of 19.1%. The top two groups, with incomes above $100,000, had an average unemployment of 3.6%. So there you have it. The richer you are, the less likely you are to be unemployed. Keep the poor, keep the wage slaves in check. On international labor news, unions and police just clashed in Egypt. Just hundreds of textile workers have clashed with riot police in Cairo after a demonstration against the privatization of a factory. The Tanta Linen Flax and Oil Company was sold off by the government 4 years ago. Workers who say their pay and conditions have suffered have held a series of strikes. And on Wednesday, demonstrators took to the streets outside the cabinet office in central Cairo, and police responded. Trade unions have emerged as a serious force in Egyptian politics in recent years, correspondents say. But their move to take their demonstration to the streets of Cairo, near the seat of government, is seen as an unusual move. Egypt has strong laws against public demonstrations, and riot police moved in to break up the sit-in. I may point out that the dictatorship in Egypt, led by Mubarak, has been supported by the United States for many years. The United States has been, you know, very clearly in favor of supporting some of these very, very harsh dictatorships in the Middle East for purposes that are, you know, quite clear, having to do with number one, destroying some of the Arab nationalist aspirations that were such a threat to U.S. control of the region, particularly the oil. And secondly, you know, the sort of standard pattern around the world that you need a strong dictatorship or at least anything that will prevent workers in the third world from organizing and, you know, lowering the profit rate that foreign investors reap, you know, by, you know, investing in these third world countries. Let's not forget that their purpose is to provide cheap labor and resources. So a strong dictatorship intimidating and terrorizing people is actually pretty good at preventing unions and social movements from fighting for their rights. And in El Salvador, it's been reported, something that of course has been going on for a long time, but that there's an appalling situation in the export processing zones. So this is a report from a few days ago in Brussels by the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC study on core labor standards in El Salvador. It reports that many of the 67,000 mostly women workers employed in the country's 15 export processing zones suffer from appalling treatment ranging from verbal abuse and threats to physical abuse and sexual harassment. There is a clear anti-trade union policy and dismissal of workers planning to join or form a union. Many consider that working conditions in export processing zones can be assimilated to forced labor. Victoriano Abel Vega, the general secretary of the Sindicato de Trabajadores y Empleados Municipales de la Alcaldía de Santa Ana, so basically a trade union, was murdered on his way to San Salvador, where he was due to attend a meeting with several other trade unionists in preparation for a complaints procedure regarding the unfair dismissal of several employees of the municipality of Santa Ana in breach of conventions 87 and 80 and 98. Of course, you know, we go back to the notion that conventions and laws may actually defend workers' rights, but on the field, in reality, that's just not something that is respected nor enforced by the governments or corporations. So yeah, there we have it. And I may point out that another South American country, Colombia, holds the record in murder of trade unionists. And it's the leadership there, the government of Uribe, has been supported by the United States pretty strongly, and now they are installing new military bases in the country to strengthen their foothold, their influence. So I guess that does it for labor news. And on international news, I've reported a few days back that there's a very large offensive being planned against a region in Afghanistan, and the United States is going to be leading it, and some other countries are volunteering some troops. But Russia just stated that they will not send troops to Afghanistan. Says Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev reiterated Russia's longstanding vow to never again send soldiers to Afghanistan, where the former Soviet Union lost 14,500 military personnel in its 1979-1989 campaign against Taliban insurgents, the occupation of Afghanistan. The comments came after NATO Secretary Anders Fogh suggested Sunday at a Munich of Germany security conference that he did not rule out the possibility of Russia joining NATO's anti-Taliban operations. And Patrushev says, "We are strongly opposed to our military role in operations in Afghanistan. A key to the Afghan problem lies in the political rather than military domain." See, that's an important insight right there, that the Russians themselves would say this, who have more experience in Afghanistan than almost anybody, would say that the key is a political rather than a military solution. And you know, like I said, there's no evidence that the United States really wants to prevent terrorism, as they say, because it was predicted that the threat of terrorism would increase with the invasion of Afghanistan and, of course, Iraq. And some postulate that the two main reasons why the U.S. keeps fighting, number one is because they want to control that strategic region, which is sort of the door to Asia, and sort of also strategically placed in the Middle East. It also is a matter of credibility. It's one of the main features of nation states, where they do not want to be seen as weak, because that may erode, being seen as weak erodes their standing, and so they have to maintain credibility, and sort of like the mafia, and that seems to be a very strong component in the equation here. At the same time, in Afghanistan, the United Nations just forecasted a stable Afghan opium crop. Says UN predicts a stable 2010 Afghan opium cultivation and warns of fewer poppy-free provinces. Says after a major drop over the past 2 years, Afghanistan's opium cultivation is unlikely to rise or fall dramatically in 2010. Their report by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says a bad weather may lead to a decrease in opium production, but warned the country could see fewer poppy-free provinces. Afghanistan, as you guys probably know, supplies 90% of the world's opium, the main ingredient in heroin, and the highly lucrative crop has actually helped finance insurgents and fueled what they call corruption. So, yeah, it's not clear what the United States does about this. The United States, as we know, is not really interested in preventing drug production. In fact, the CIA, as Alfred McCoy reported, was very, very deeply involved in drug trafficking in Indochina back in the 70s, and so it wouldn't be anything new. And its drug policies in South America, it's claimed anti-drug policies like fumigation in Colombia, is a bad joke because it's very ineffective, and they keep doing it. So that can only signal that there's something else going on, and what their interest and I mean, in South America, it's counterinsurgency, and in Afghanistan is has nothing to do with fighting drugs or fighting terrorism. That's all a bad pretext. So we're approaching the half hour mark, and we're gonna take a music break. And when we come back, we will answer your questions. And you can call in if you want. The number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And let's play something here, some song. Let's play the Oaxaca song. We'll be back in a few minutes. The Oaxaca song, and we're back on the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And I guess what we could do is go into today in history. And so back in 1790, today is of course Thursday, today's February 11th. And so February 11th, 1790, in the United States, a Society of Friends petitions Congress to emancipate slaves. So that was a very significant event. Fast forward to 1861, the United States, the House unanimously passes resolution guaranteeing non-interference with slavery in any state. Then fast forward to 1902. In the Netherlands, police beat up universal suffrage demonstrators in Brussels. So this is to remind folks that struggles go on around the world all the time. We are sort of we focus a lot on the United States because we live here and we in this center of power. So it's important to take action over here, but we should not forget that there's stuff going on all over the place, and it had been going on, has been going on for since the advent of the Industrial Revolution. 1913, the United States, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, leads a rubber strike in Akron, Ohio. The Akron rubber workers will do it again in 1936 and 37 at the General Tire Company of Akron, a scene of the first sit-down strike in rubber. The report here says the first major strike in 1913 represented an end of innocence. The action, which included workers from all of Akron's rubber shops, began after the introduction of machinery that made tires easier to build and resulted in lower price rates, lower piece rates for the workers. The strike was loosely directed by the Industrial Workers of the World, a radical group named nicknamed the Wobblies, and it lasted more than 5 weeks. The workers made no gains, however. They did not even manage to shut down the rubber shops. The strike served chiefly to disillusion company executives. So, very often this is a phenomenon that we see in strikes that it sort of it seems like we're losing the strike down till the very end, like there's no hope. But and there's all these struggles, all these awful things that go on, but almost invariably at the end, there's always something gained, and even if it's just solidarity, but very often you actually do get some substantial material gains. You get concessions from management. So strikes and labor solidarity and collective action do work. I mean, it's just proven, and the numbers don't lie. That the people who are in unions make between 20 to 30% more in average wages. In Europe, it's about 20, I think it's 23, 24%. Here is closer to 30. The United States has the highest increase in wages due to unionization. So it's it works. Anyway, fast forward to 1916. In the United States, Emma Goldman is arrested for lecturing on birth control. And this goes back to what we've heard over and over again about the First Amendment, how it provides us with the freedom of speech that we now enjoy. But in reality, it's another law on the books that unless the people themselves enforce, their authorities, whose job is supposedly to respect the laws, they will not respect the right to free speech for any views that fundamentally dissent from the status quo. So there you have it. 1919, Seattle General Strike ends. Harvey O'Connor, Sympathetic Revolution in Seattle, remains the best book on this event. And online, you can also read about it on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And there's even a website here called, I guess I'll post it on the Seattle General Strike. So it's a project page. I can post it on the chat room. There's so many labor events that require some of the some knowledge. Anyway, so fast forward to 1937. 48,000 General Motors workers who began a 44-day sit-down strike on December 30th, 1936, the year before, they win today. So they after 44 days, they win. And it's called the Great Flint Sit-Down Strike. And Flint was possibly the most completely controlled of any company town in the country. So think about this. The place where it's least likely that for like any person being in that environment would feel very discouraged. Wow, there I feel like there's if I do anything I'll get fired, blah blah blah. This was the most tightly controlled place, and yet they won. Because the idea for the sit-down strike arose from an incident on a baseball field when auto workers playing a baseball game discovered the the ump was a non-union man and sat down on the field in protest. General Motors recognizes the United Auto Workers, UAW, and 2 months later, company guards end up beating up UAW leaders at the River Rouge, Michigan plant. But nevertheless, they were recognized, and it paid off. It did. And they're saying how they led the audience in some with some union songs like Solidarity Forever, Hold the Fort, and others. And playing the banjo, they made the walls ring with words familiar to many as a paraphrase of the old saying, hold the fort, for we are coming, union men, be strong, side by side we battle onward, victory will come. So there you have it. 1964... In the United States, 19,000 students boycott Cincinnati schools to protest segregation. That's around the time of the Civil Rights Movement. 1987, Ronald Reagan tells the Tower Commission he did not approve arms sales to Iran, which is, of course, a big fat lie, as we know, from the Iran-Contra scandal that broke out after that. But, you know, we're not surprised when heads of state lie, since their very shtick is to deceive the public. And in 1990, South Africa, political prisoner Nelson Mandela is released after 27 years in prison by the U.S.-supported apartheid government of South Africa for the crime of high treason. I may point out that the Reagan administration, Cheney, and all these folks, they actually labeled Mandela a terrorist. It says, Mandela and scores of other Rivonia treason trialists were arrested after a raid on a farmhouse in Rivonia, Johannesburg, in which plans for a guerrilla confrontation with the apartheid state was planned, and they were sent to prison following a seven-month trial in 64 at the Palace of Justice in Pretoria. Somebody's asking me what's the source for Radical History. It's called The Daily Bleed, www.eskimo.com. That's where I find the Radical History. It's an excellent website. So, anyway, I want to remind listeners, you can call in if you have any comments you want to make, any questions you have, anything you want to talk about. The number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And, well, it's more of the same, really, folks. As far as some of the current problems that we're having, and yesterday we announced that there's an anti-war movement that is building up again after it died off, you know, after the election of Obama. And hopefully we'll get it going again on March 20th. I urge everyone to get involved. There's going to be an anti-war demonstration in several cities around the world, especially here in the United States. So here in San Francisco, also in Washington, D.C., New York City, March 20th, get involved, do something about the current wars, because the massacre will continue, and there's a huge offensive, as I said, being planned, and that's going to be like Fallujah, but probably even worse. It's going to be an even bigger massacre. So, you know, we have a responsibility to stop the occupation of Afghanistan, as well as Iraq, of course, and that's going to take a strong anti-war movement. It's going to take unrest. It's going to take countering the tea protesters as well, since a lot of them they have all these skewed priorities about what should be the policy of the of the United States government. So I'm going to go ahead and play a song, and then when we come back, if you guys have any questions, we will continue reporting the news and hearing what you have to say. So I'm going to play Guantanamera, a song sung by Pete Seeger. All right, be back in a minute.
Back about 60 miles from where I live in the Hudson Valley is a big city. And on 59th Street, 7th Avenue, the old statue of the fellow that wrote the words of this next song. Jose Marti, 1895. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crecen las palmas. Y antes de morir me quiero, echa mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Hey, you know, no sense in me singing it all by myself. Let me teach it to you. Even if you never sang a note of Spanish, you can get those two words. Guantanamera. Repeat. Guantanamera. Now you know half of the chorus. Guajira. Guajira. Now you know the whole chorus. Sing it. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Oh, sing it out. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Mi verso es de un verde claro y de un carmín encendido. Mi verso es de un verde claro y de un carmín encendido. Mi verso es un ciervo herido que busca en el monte amparo. Guantanamera, Guantanamera, con los pobres de la tierra quiero yo mi suerte echar. Con los pobres de la tierra quiero yo mi suerte echar. El arroyo de la sierra me complace más que el mar. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Oh, sing it out. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. One more time. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
That was Guantanamera, a song written by, what's his name? Marti, the Cuban revolutionary, and sung by Pete Seeger. We're back on the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And, well, I'm waiting for people to call in. I wanted to ask you guys a question because in 2008 I did this video montage called The Evilness of Power. And then 2009, I edited this documentary called Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Politics, thanks to the help of Buttigieg, David Bukola, and Charnchi Wei, who helped me out recording Thomas Ferguson and also doing other things. But I'm thinking about a third project. I'm trying to think of any ideas for a third documentary, something that would actually be relevant to our current predicament, and I was thinking about maybe doing something on some of the, you know, dangers to our survival. I always touch on that in every film project I do. So I'm not exactly sure what I want to do. So if you guys want to suggest anything, I would really appreciate that. I was actually talking to someone at Borders yesterday, and she was a professor of economics, and I asked her, "Oh wow, did you get your PhD?" And she said, "Yeah, I got a PhD in economics." And I said, "What was your thesis on?" She said, "Well, my thesis was on altruism." And I thought that was really interesting. And she didn't really specify very much what the thesis was about. I think it was pretty speculative, having to do with psychology, social relations, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a few books on the subject that I mentioned, and she didn't seem to be aware of them. And one of them is called The Gift by French anthropologist Marcel Mauss. And this is a book that was written a long time ago, 100 years ago. And it basically talks about the economies, what are called moral economies. So instead of a market economy, where I give you something, you give me something in exchange, it's basically a gift economy, where I give you something, and then you feel morally obligated to give me something back. So it's not a formal exchange, but in effect, you can sort of enslave someone in a moral, make them feel obligated to give you something back. But the source of the quote-unquote enslavement is a moral urge. So if I give you something, it's you feel bad if you don't give it back to me, or you don't give me, you give something back to me. So it's a different dynamic than a market system, a gift economy. And some indigenous societies had that type of system. And of course, the goal of libertarian communism, or anarchist communism, as you wanna, however you wanna call it, some of the people that that experimented with that actually implemented a gift economy. So in some villages in Spain, you had people who basically gave up money. They were not even using money anymore, and they were, just providing people with what they needed, and that old saying, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need," and that was the principle that was applied. Now, that's not the only principle compatible with libertarian socialism. I mean, Pericon, which emphasizes effort and sacrifice towards a socially useful task, that's another way to go, there's a good description of this by Chomsky in his interview on anarcho-syndicalism. I think it was in 1976. There's a transcript of the interview on the BBC interview on his website. But he says, well, there's two ways to go about doing it. You either, actually, he was talking about tasks that are wanted, so there's a certain range of tasks that everybody wants to do because they like it. Maybe you like being a carpenter. I like being a video editor, and I like planting trees, whatever. Everybody has their preferences. And what he was saying is, well, there's a range of activities that people may not want to perform because it's a pain in the ass. Maybe nobody wants to take out the trash, although I don't believe that. I think people do want to help. But let's suppose there's a range of tasks that nobody wants to do. So Chomsky says, what's obvious? Well, there's two options. You either reward those tasks more, that is, you reward according to effort and sacrifice, or those tasks have to be divided in the community among people, among the people who live in the community. So let's say that we live in a collective and nobody wants to wash the dishes. So we have two choices. Either the person who washes the dishes gets extra privileges because due to his effort and sacrifice, or the task of washing the dishes is divided among those who participate. So anyway, we have a caller, and Let's see who this is. Hello, you there?
Hey, this is Zeno.
Hey, Zeno. Nice to hear from you,
hey,
man.
Hey, haven't been able to call in, but sorry about that. How about a documentary on organizing different styles and different tactics, you know, things that work and don't work?
Yeah, actually, right. Sort of like I keep talking about that book Labor Notes, which has all these different tactics on how to organize. But the thing is that look like a lot of these documentaries, it's hard to make them entertaining. So,
yeah.
So what, like for example, this one that I did, it was a lot like a lecture. It was like a lecture where I try to make it entertaining by adding images and stuff like that, adding a little music here and there. But let's say that I was going to do that, you know, a documentary about organizing, I would have to, get some people to, you know, pretend that they are the workers or the boss or something like that. Or I could report back on examples in history, you know, if there's some footage of some strikes, say, well, this is how the workers did it. Then I have somebody reporting on that, kind of a people's history of organizing, something like that. You know, I guess there's a play after Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, right? So there's something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you've used lots of really cool clips of the Spanish Civil War, stuff like that, and, you know, do some of the old coal strikes, mining strikes, and stuff like that. Like, I'm reading through this book right now. It's from a series called History of Labor Movement in the United States, like on Volume 5, the AFL and the Progressive Era, by Philip S. Foner. It's pretty good. I haven't completely finished it yet, but you know, you kind of see how a lot of the stuff is pretty much the same, and not much has changed. Like, I'm reading articles from, like, 1910 and stuff describing the political system and how corrupt Washington is and everything, and it's just like, you know, you list the date off of this thing, and it's like somebody writing contemporary.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, and I think that's important to note as well, that even though there's a lot of changes in our system, the basic structure remains the same. So some of the dynamics are going to stay the same as well, and that's why we can learn from past struggles. But I don't know. So you think that would be a good idea, a documentary about labor tactics, labor struggles. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll certainly have that in mind. Any other ideas or
I was also thinking, besides, the economics, but yeah, again,
right, you know,
how would you do that?
You know, it's funny because,
especially on Paracon,
I was really interested for a while in, a book called Debunking Economics, because if you read the section C of the anarchist FAQ at infoshop.org, they have a very long section on refuting capitalist economics, and then also there's this economist that we interviewed here on the show many months ago called Steve Keen. He's a sort of a neo Keynesian economist, partly Marxian as well, but he has a very strong critique of modern economics, and I thought, hey, maybe I should do a documentary, called Debunking Economics or something like that. But see, the problem with all these documentaries is that they may not appeal to a lot of people. So what if I refute some technical aspects that people are not even interested in to begin with? So it's problematic. I mean, with Golden Rule, I've only gotten something like 4,000 hits on the Vimeo account. Whereas Evilness of Power, which was a collage, a montage that I did in 2008, got tens of thousands of hits. You know, it was more successful because I think it was more it was less technical, more entertaining. And, you know, it's hard, too, because in our culture, we're so used to stuff that is really cool and entertaining.
Yeah, I think it worked kind of good, broken up on YouTube, the way it was kind of serialized there, you know? Maybe like a serialized rather than, you know, format, rather than just sitting down and listening to a lecture on film, you know, at your laptop or your computer for like 2 hours.
You
Yeah,
know what?
maybe break it up.
Right, and maybe even do a shorter project instead of a 1 hour and a half documentary. But Charnchi it just suggested that I do a one on what he calls social implications of our moral instincts. So
Oh,
basically,
that's a good one.
yeah, I guess incorporating some of the theories of Kropotkin, mutual aid, stuff like that. it's not easy to figure out what would be. See, the thing is, it's hard to know exactly what's the most relevant because there's so many things that are relevant. But
Yeah.
yeah, I don't know. Is there anything that has caught your attention in the past year or so about our society that needs to be addressed?
Oh, there's this great, I'm trying to find it on like Googling and stuff here. I think his name is Robert or Richard Wolff, is the Marxian economist. I think
Actually, I.
capitalism hit the fan or something.
Right. Yeah, he's good. He's good.
But yeah, maybe you could like interview him or something.
Yeah, he. In fact, I for Golden Rule, like, I emailed him and I asked him, what was the cause of? Actually, I emailed like three guys. I emailed Thomas Ferguson. I emailed Steve Keen. I emailed Richard Wolff to ask them about. Like, what was the cause? What was the reason why, after the 1970s, you had a great deregulation and growth of the financial sector, which now makes about 44% of all corporate profits in the economy, which is much higher than it used to be. And the reason that he gave me had to do with the fact that workers were sort of made to be addicted to consumption. And that and that as as they had gained more rights in the 1960s, then basically there was a backlash and doing things like exporting jobs or outsourcing jobs to other places and sort of class warfare. And anyway, so what happened was that the wages of workers went down, so the average American worker is making less, or at least maybe not more than in the 70s, adjusted for inflation. And so what happened was that as they made less, they wanted to maintain their consumption, so they relied more on debt, on credit card debt. And so as you increase the debt in the economy, obviously banks got stronger, more influential, hedge funds and other institutions that benefit from debt and
Yeah, no more
therefore,
real autonomy. Yeah.
right. And so that's what hap that's what he that's what he explained happened to increase the profit of the financial sector. So yeah, he definitely has an explanation that I mean, I always say we anarchists need to understand the Marxist view on economics, because I think a lot of anarchists are kind of weak on economics. They don't really look at it very
90
much.
seconds.
But anyway, I guess we're getting close to the end
All
of the
right, thanks.
program. So thanks for calling, man, and I want to thank everyone for listening. And we're gonna close the show, and we'll be back tomorrow at around the same time. So I want to play 5 Million Ways to Kill a CEO. We'll be back. Good night.